I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It's Wednesday, March 18th. Good afternoon, committee.
We have four
bills in front of us today. We're going to try to go in order as much as we can. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2325. And Victoria, can I have some people come up during work session?
Yes.
You have to talk to us?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to have Neil Jackson and whoever else from the trial lawyers come forward at this point. Welcome, gentlemen. Before us, we have House Bill 2325 and the Dash 1 Amendment. And you've also submitted, and I don't know if all the committees seen it, they perhaps have, they submitted some information from Oregon and Washington policies. So we've had the public hearing on this bill. I just wanted a chance for you to talk to us about it. But before you do, Victoria, can you describe the bill and the amendment to us real briefly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2325 modifies the amount of reimbursement due personal injury protection provider when total benefits exceed damages. The Dash 1 amendments extend coverage for medical expenses from 1 year to 2 years from date of injury.
Thank you. So if either one of you would like to just briefly explain to us the concept of the bill and the amendment from your perspective.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association in support of House Bill 2325. Yes. Again, to refresh the members' recollection of the hearing that we had. The purpose of this bill is to simply make the consumer whole. The Dash 2 amendment does not extend all PIP payments beyond 1 year. It extends only the medical payments. The present law is that medical payments and wage replacement payments end at 1 year, 52 weeks. This Dash 2 amendment only extends the payment for the medical bills. It does not extend the
So excuse me, we're looking at a Dash 1 amendment. Are you?
Am I? I'm sorry.
Just want to make sure we're not confused here.
All right.
I understand what he was talking about. No, I'm not going to be confused.
I'm not totally
clear. That was a good idea.
The two-year provision, again, is as to medical payments only. It's not as to wage payments. If you recall, another bill that was before this committee raised the wages to a maximum of $3,000. It is 2 years now for medical payments only under this amendment.
Right.
So we are talking about Dash 1 amendment?
We are talking about the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure we were on the same page, same amendment.
Right. And the other thing, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I might add, this amendment does not raise the maximum payment of the medical bills. In other words, whatever the limitation that the consumer purchases, if they purchase a $15,000 limit medical payment, which is the minimum in the state, that won't go up. It's simply that it doesn't stop in 1 year. If there is still funds left and they haven't exhausted the $15,000 limit, those payments, if reasonable and necessary for treatment, would continue either through the second year or until that limit was reached, and then it would stop.
Thank you. And then speaking to what the original bill does by itself.
The original bill Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, would make the consumer whole. Presently, the insurance company literally stands in front of the consumer for reimbursement when the case is resolved. If you have a situation where you have a limited policy, the at-fault driver has a minimum policy of $25,000 for liability. There is an accident, and the injured party is hurt really badly. And they go ahead and draw their PIP payments up to their limit. Let's assume it's $15,000 limit, which is the minimum. They draw those payments. Then their company is no longer obligated to continue to pay those medical bills. Doesn't matter how long. They've exhausted their limits. If the consumer continues to have treatment, and in my example, continues to have treatment to the tune of $9,500, they then have a total of $24,500 in medical bills. They then go to the at-fault party and say, give me your liability limits. It's your fault. I've been hurt. Give me your limits. The liability policy is turned over to the consumer, $25,000. The consumer's PIP carrier gets the first $15,000. The consumer then has $10,000 that are not paid, that they then take what's left, and they pay the rest of the medical bills off. This bill changes that situation. What it does is it says the consumer is to be made whole first. Then if there is money left, if there are excess funds, their insurance company, their PIP carrier, would be reimbursed to the extent of their payments or to the extent of the available funds from the at-fault party's policy. And that's the change. The consumer goes first, then their carrier follows them in terms of reimbursement for the damages that the consumer is entitled to.
Thank you. And I just briefly want you to talk about what you provided the committee as far as the premium comparisons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, we, at the request of the committee, we gathered together some policies from Washington, which is a make-whole state. Their consumers come first, then the insurance companies, the PIP carriers over there, come second. What we wanted to do was compare the costs of PIP coverage in Washington versus the cost of PIP coverage in Oregon. What you see is we actually gave you the declaration sheets for the policies that we looked at, and the only way we could break it down was by amounts of coverage for PIP, because in Washington they have different minimums than we do. And so what we did is we broke it down into $5,000 per unit PIP coverage. And the chart you will see is the differences in value or in costs. I'm sorry, the premium costs between Washington and Oregon per $5,000 of coverage. And the end result was it costs 5 cents per $5,000 coverage more in Oregon than it does in Washington. Now I'm not going to represent to you that this is representative of the however many 100,000 policies that may exist in each state, but these were the ones that we could get our hands on, and these are random policies that we pulled, and we took those numbers and we broke them down for you because we thought it was a real concern on the increase in premiums. And as it turns out, Washington across the river, they're a make-whole state. We're not. And it's only 5 cents per $5,000 coverage difference.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
I am so totally confused, and I apologize. Is this a gut and stuff?
No.
So this is, well, it says in line two of the printed bill, it sounds like we're changing an ORS instead of 742.544. It's now 0.524. Correct? So then that, doesn't that take out line 3 to 16?
No,
no?
No, because
it's... Here's the word and. It says 742.524 and.
Yeah, we're replacing section 2. Section 2 of the bill.
Okay, and so who asked for the amendment?
We did.
I'm trying to remember.
Change it from 1 year to 2 year. I think
right.
We did. Sure.
We, Well, I think I was what we were discussing was in the state of Washington. It was three years
in Washington,
and Oregon was at 1 year. So the amendment now expands it to 2 years from 1 year.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Widener, I believe you had a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, when we were going through this earlier, in earlier testimony, it seems like I recall, and I believe it was from the trial lawyers that are up right now, that it was going to increase premiums when they'd looked at that point, $60 a year is what was on testimony.
From the insurance?
Well, when they had done their research before, the information they gave us was they were saying $60 a year that it would increase premiums going, and that was with the 1 year in effect at that time to make it full.
I don't recall that comment, but.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Widener, I do recall that when I testified, I was talking about my policy. I don't recall saying 60, but if I did, I did. But I was only talking about my policy. As a result of the request of the committee, it seemed to me it was more appropriate to get some random policies and come up with these numbers. My policy is based on what I was quoted by my agent. But that's the best I can respond.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jackson, I want to understand in the bill itself, I understand the amendment, but in the bill itself, where we have, where the current law says economic damages, loss of wage is not an economic damage. I'm trying to figure out if under the current law you get made whole first on your wages.
Wages, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wingard, wages are an economic damage.
So, Mr. Chair,
follow up.
Under the current law, it says economic damages. You're taking that out to broaden the scope, but under your example of the PIP payments, it does not. I'm confused. Does the current law allow you to be made whole on your lost wages before your insurance company?
In Mr. Chairman, Representative Wingard, in the example that I gave you, no.
So as the current law reads, does the insured get made whole on under any condition for any cost whatsoever?
Yes. If, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wingard, if the injuries to the consumer are, and I'll just concoct a hypothetical that I think addresses your question. If a consumer suffers a relatively minor injury, and I'll just throw some example numbers out. Let's say they only have $1,000 worth of medical bills, okay? And let's assume that they only missed a month of work, and under present law, they've got $1,250 in wage loss that PIP pays. They would be made whole in the scenario where the at-fault driver has a $25,000 policy because there would be reimbursement under the present law. There would be reimbursement for the medical bills that were paid by their PIP. There would be reimbursement for the wage loss that was paid by their PIP. And if there was a disparity between, which there probably would be, between their wage loss that was paid, the $1,250, and what they actually earned, they would be entitled to recover the difference between those two. And if they had some kind of a permanent injury, relatively minor, albeit, in that scenario, with relatively minor injuries, the consumer is made whole under the present law. This law, if I may, this law is to address the situations where it's a much more severe injury and there is not enough liability coverage to fully compensate for that. This doesn't affect every case by any means. It affects the most serious injuries where there simply is not enough coverage under the liability policy to fully make the consumer whole.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm still a little confused. Can you tell me how removing the word economic from current law changes this. And I'm trying to understand what is different when the word, what is suddenly available and changed when we remove the word economic from this sentence.
Chair Holby, Representative Wingard, if
you could identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Tom Diamore for the Oregon Trial Lawyers. It would be non-economic damages. That would add, injured party has to be made whole as to economic and non-economic damages, or at least to as much of the policies available.
Mr. Chair. Representative Wingard. So again, under the scenario you were given, I'm trying to understand if you're currently, the policyholder is currently able to be made whole for economic damages. And what you're hoping to do with this bill is to expand to non-economic damages, the types of items that they can be made whole from. But it seems to me that a wage loss is an economic damage.
Right.
So how are they not currently able to be made whole under the law with the word economic damage in there?
Well, there's two types of damages, the economic damages and the non-economic damages. And the example that Mr. Jackson gave, if they've paid $15,000 in PIP and then the injured party has to go another $9,500 out of pocket for additional medical expenses or additional wage loss, that only leaves $500 left of the $25,000 policy. And so that person, while they may be made whole as to the PIP that was reimbursed, are not made whole with $500.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, just for the sake of clarifying the discussion, can you perhaps give some examples of what economic damages are and also perhaps what non-economic damages are in real application? I think that will help us out.
Okay, economic damages would be medical expenses, wage loss, but it would also be future medical expenses, wage loss. Non-economic damages are the type of damages, for instance, if a mother of four is killed. That mother does not necessarily, if she's a stay-home mom, does not necessarily have any type of wage loss, and she wouldn't even necessarily have any medical expenses if she was killed instantly. So the only other damages that family can recover on behalf of that mother is non-economic damages, the loss of their mother, the loss of services, the loss of contribution that a mother would make to the family.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions, thank you for going over the bill for us.
Thank you, Chair Holt.
I don't see Steve Merrill or John Powell, who were also presenting this bill, the other side of this bill. And did we receive any information on from them on the premium costs from Washington to Oregon?
Not that I recall.
Okay, thank you. So,
are you ready for a motion? Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2325.
Thank you. Representative Riley moves the Dash 1 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2325. Discussion? Opposition? Not seeing any opposition, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move, does this have a subsequent?
No.
I move House Bill 2325 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
And just to clarify, we do have the
Dash 1 amendment.
We do have the fiscals and the revenue impact statements. So Representative Riley moves the House Bill 2325 to the floor with as amended with a due pass recommendation. Cindy, I believe we need a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Chair, any discussion on that before?
Discussion. Hold off on the roll call vote. Discussion, Representative Wingard.
I still don't claim to fully understand this bill, and I think as a legislator I'm supposed to. But I guess my main concern, which I'm going to restate from a previous hearing, is that we are in pieces taking up bills on auto insurance without
the committee, I believe, having a full understanding of the cumulative effect on people's insurance rates by those bills. Personally, I would have preferred to take them all together and have the committee decide which, if any, to pass as a group with a full understanding of what we were doing in this session to raise people's insurance rates. In addition, rather than have either the insurance lobby or the trial lawyers come forward and give us their guesstimate as to what it would do, we have a state agency that oversees insurance rates, and I think it would be helpful to the committee to have a statement from them on these bills assessing what they think it would do as far as raising or lowering insurance rates. I'd be a lot more comfortable as a committee member making decisions on bills like this that have merit, with the understanding that I can go back to my constituents with an, you know, fully aware of how much it's going to cost them to do it. We don't have that information. I'm not suggesting that I'm not convinced to vote against the bill on that, but I just wanted to raise that concern that I think there might have been.
Well, thank you. I'll respond to that just briefly, I appreciate your concern, and albeit I might have liked to have had both these bills combined in one, but that's not the way they came to us or the way they came out of drafting. And sometimes to consider the cumulative effect, we looked at the effect of the first bill, and now we're adding that bill to it. You know, I don't know that I have any other PIP bills on our agenda. I won't say that for sure, but I'm not remembering one at the moment. And so, and in regard to having a statement from the insurance division during public hearing or at any time, any member of the body could ask the insurance division for that information, and still certainly there's time to do that between now and when this bill makes it through the process, but I'm not inclined to hold the bill up or this committee up for that at this point. So, I'd encourage you to contact the insurance division yourself if you would like to have a statement from them. I think the chair is comfortable to go ahead and move this bill out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other discussion? Cindy, can I have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2325, having received the proper votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2325.
Carrying that bill, Mr. Chair?
Representative Barton, would you like to carry the bill?
I'd love to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You can be our PIP guy. Thank you. Next up, I'd like to open a... I'm going to skip in the agenda briefly and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2527. And Representative Gelser. I don't know if you're busy right now, but I want to get you up and present the bill, because I know you're always busy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And before you start, Victoria, can you give us a brief description of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2527 requires elected officials and state agencies that provide electronic information to the public to disclose any embedded tracking features. It exempts information obtained through use of electronic tracking features from public records disclosure requirements.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and welcome to our committee. And
you
identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, I'm Sarah Gelser. I'm a state representative from House District 16
And I can say with all honesty that this has been the best part of my day to get to come and see you. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about this.
Sorry about that.
You must be having a bad day.
I really feel sad.
I feel better
now.
About my day now.
My day is even worse.
This is a fun little bill. It's really very simple, and this is a matter of public records law and basic common sense disclosure catching up with the technology we have in the world. Many of us send out electronic newsletters, as do state agencies and others, that have in them embedded technology that tracks the recipients of these newsletters, and it tells us who received them, who opened them, what time they opened them, who they forwarded them to, if the people they forwarded them to opened them, what order they forwarded people to, and what order of links, what order they went in and clicked on the links. And this is, you know, many of us worry about this in terms of consumer protection and businesses mining that information for consumer purposes, which is not my concern about the government, but I did have constituents that contacted me that were concerned that they should be made aware when this information was there, and that on top of that, the order in which people do their clicks, the people that they forward e-newsletters to, that information itself should not be subject to disclosure to the public. That shouldn't be part of the public record. As you know, all the emails we receive, all of that is public record. So the way that I envision this bill, the only thing it would do is to, one, on the bottom of your newsletter, if you're a government agency or an elected official, you would simply state that there is embedded tracking software in there, and you could probably say it in a less threatening kind of way than your government is watching you, and that information would be prohibited from release as part of a public records disclosure. And it's about protecting the privacy of people who are communicating with their government. And that's it. But I'm happy to answer any questions. I've had a lot of questions about this bill.
Fascinating. Didn't you know this existed?
I did.
Oh. Representative Winger, a question?
Representative Gilser, you clearly have better tracking software than I do on your newsletter. So can you please tell me which provider you're using? Because I'd like all that forwarded in.
I'm sure they would be happy to have your business.
Seriously, who are you using?
Seriously, who do I use? I use Mandate Mail.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Representative Gilser, how is this different than from... This is all public record anyway in our email systems currently. If we're shipping email out of our offices or any elected official right. throughout the state, it's public record, so people have access to that anyway. How does this change that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews. This wouldn't impact that at all. All of the emails, all of that would still be public record. This just says that how that constituent is behaving in their own home, what time they read their email, who they choose to forward certain pieces of information to, that is not in the public interest for other people to know that. What we're sending out, the information that we're sharing, the information that we're receiving, clearly that is appropriately public record. But what private citizens are doing in terms of what they're reading and who they're choosing to share information with, I believe that is personal information.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I'm just curious, and this is because of the city system we use, which is Outlook Exchange. If you send a read receipt out, it comes back to you in your mailbox as a read receipt, and it tells you that. That is public record. So how do we get away from that? That particular document that comes back into your mail system is another email that gets generated back into your inbox, unless I'm missing something. So with that, are we saying we want to eliminate that from public record? I'm sorry, I don't want to cause any grief. I'm trying to understand how this is going to impact and how it's going to be different.
I appreciate that. Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews, my intention for this bill is it would not impact that. You are clicking that. When you receive that return receipt, you have the option of whether or not to send that back. It is information that you know that you are transmitting. This goes to embedded tracking software where individuals don't know that they're transmitting that information back to us or back to the Department of Human Services or back to the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Wingert again.
I'm just going to let everybody else go. But Representative Gilser, if I understand it, you have two sections here. One where you want a disclosure, that kind of tracking information, is occurring. And then the second one is to, the second section, or second part of section one is designed essentially to not allow a public records request to gain access to that information.
Thank you. Representative Holvey, Representative Wingard, yes.
Thank you.
I'm much more comfortable with the second part.
Representative Riley?
I was just asking if Representative Barton's gone. Maybe I should ask.
Go ahead.
the way I see it, and I don't know, the newspapers are here, they're gonna testify. Maybe, are the newspapers signed up for this?
Nobody signed up.
Okay. This is another piece of, taking something out of public records law, and there have been people who have been objecting mm-hmm. very strongly to the piecemeal taking out of public records law. I think this is a good one. Do you have any qualms about the chipping away at the public records law?
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, I do have qualms generally about chipping away at the public records law, and in fact this is a sunshine week when we're focused on the importance of public records, and I generally am very cautious about removing things from public record. This is the type of information that has never been part of the information of the public record before. If you mail out a hard copy newsletter, it's not part of the public record what that person does in their kitchen when they read it, which part they read first, whether or not they make a photocopy and give it to someone else. So it's not taking access away for something that has been there for a long time for the public to access. And there's really no public interest in knowing what Joe Black does when he receives his newsletter from whether it be an agency or the government. And I think the issue is it's really basically a statement on the first part of the bill. It's a statement of the privacy practices. They're the same kinds of things that we ask businesses to do to opt in and out for privacy practices. It would just be having us be at the same standard, recognizing that now it's a government entity that has this information as opposed to a business.
Mr.
Chair. Thank you. Tim Krieger.
I kind of feel, because I'm not a tech person, but the technology has changed so much in the last 10, 15 years that the law that we passed about open records didn't ever envision the way we could get access today. So it's completely changed, and that's how I look at it. So we have to adapt a little bit to that.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate your comments. Representative Wingard, do you have another question?
Well, just a helpful suggestion here on the part one of section mm-hmm. one. I think the last line seven and eight where you use the phrase describing any electronic tracking features. I think this bill is going to be probably a lot more palatable if you just decide what the phrase is that we have to use. In other words, write it, and then we all know. We just have to place that exact phrase at the end of the newsletter rather than that, which who knows what that will turn into. And you had mentioned you didn't want it to be scary, but who knows what that will turn into in the rulemaking process if we don't just decide here legislatively exactly what we want the line to be.
Thank you. I appreciate that suggestion.
Okay. I appreciate your testimony today, and I appreciate your comments, Representative Wingard. And I think I have one other person that's left to testify on this bill.
Thank you very much.
So we'll see if you have any opposition.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Gallagher representing the newspapers. No, I didn't sign up because I don't have opposition, but I would want to thank this committee for the time I've spent here on public records and for looking at this. I agree with Representative Krieger exactly. This is rebound public information that really isn't public information in that sense. When we looked at it, we said that this is not what we should be covering. I also agree with Representative Wingard that the clarity in this bill, which took me at my age about 3 weeks to figure out what it actually meant, and when our people finally explained it to me, I go, oh, okay. So thank you for your time this committee has given public records.
Since it's thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Krieger.
I think this makes the record for the easiest, simple, less controversial
bill that we've had. I might go home happy today.
It's early.
We're not done yet.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2527. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2268. And could I have up Keith Dubanovich and Andrew Shaw?
Very good.
And they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Good afternoon, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name is Keith Dubanovich, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. As the committee may recall, we were here on this bill a couple of weeks ago, and in summary, this bill is intended to address the question of what information is provided to a consumer when they have their automobile repaired. At the time we first appeared before the committee, we acknowledged that some amendments would be necessary. I'm pleased to say that we had some very successful and, I believe, productive discussions with members of the industry and also advocacy groups, and we have before you some Dash 1 amendments, which we believe make the bill very workable and helpful. In summary, the intent is to protect consumers from unexpected auto repair bills. In other words, if you show up thinking that the cost of your repair is going to be $1,000, but when you go to get your car, it turns out to be $2,000 or $2,500, that is a shock to most consumers, as it would be to me, and I'm confident members of the committee. And this bill is also intended to help reduce disputes between consumers and auto repair companies. Indeed, we believe it is helpful to the auto repair industry because it will hopefully eliminate disputes that they unfortunately have from time to time with their consumers about what's been authorized for repair and what the approved expense is for the repair. In essence, what this bill does is it requires the repair shops to provide a written estimate for vehicle repairs and to obtain permission from the consumer before they conduct any repairs that cost more than 10% above the original estimate. There are some record-keeping requirements, and again, we have conferred with the industry to make sure that those requirements are palatable to the industry. We obviously did not want to add additional burdens that would not be of benefit to the consumer or the companies that do the repairs. The good news is that most of the auto repair companies are already keeping quite good records on what work they're doing on automobiles, if for no other reason, for warranties and other issues. And again, we have worked very carefully and closely with the members of the industry to work out some amendments that we believe will make this bill more workable. A number of other states have laws similar to 2268, including with the Dash 1 amendments, and this brings Oregon in line with those other states. With me to my right is Mr. Andrew Scholl. He is with the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Group, and he would like to address the committee on the specifics of this particular bill.
And Chair Holby, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, Andrew Scholl, the Oregon Department of Justice. Mr. Dubanovich gave a great synopsis of the big picture of the statute. I would like to walk through you a little bit on the Dash 1 amendments and how that changes and alters the bill. As mentioned, we had a good active work group. We believe we came up with amendments that are reasonable and beneficial for both the consumers and the industry. We also believe the Dash 1 amendments remove requirements from the introduced version of the bill that were overly burdensome to the industry. And some of these had to do with warranty information and warranty disclosures. They were very problematic. There were issues with federal law and other laws. Those have been removed without removing sort of the key requirements for necessary information needed for consumers in these transactions. Some of the nuts and bolts of how the dash one amend the introduced version in a dramatic way. One of the things that was brought up was there are consumers at times who feel like they would like to just drop their vehicle off and go. They have a meeting. They have to get to work. They don't want to be bothered. This bill has these estimate requirements where the shop has to develop an estimate before they start work. And it's not that the estimate has to be reviewed by the person, the consumer, in person. It's just that that information has to be provided to the consumer if they would like that information. And the shop has to get authorization either orally over the telephone, through facsimile, through electronic mail. We also added in the dash one amendment other electronic messages foreseeing future technological advances so that we don't have to come back and visit this. But on those authorization requirements, the consumer, as long as those rights provided under this bill, that would be provided under this bill, are properly disclosed and explained to the consumer can, in fact, waive the authorization requirements as long as it's done in writing, signed by the consumer. And that helped alleviate the problem with consumers who like to drop off their car at a trusted shop. They don't have concerns about getting a $5,000 bill when they are expecting a $500 bill. And again, they don't want to be bothered at work. They don't want to receive emails. So they have that right to get out of it, and the shop has that right to present that option to the consumer. The other changes are the original introduced bill had a $100 minimum applicability amount, and so the authorization requirements in the bill would not apply to a deal that, to any transaction, to any repair that was $100 or less, or less than $100. In speaking with the shops and speaking with the industry, it was found that that number wasn't necessarily unreasonable, but given the costs of repairs and some even very basic sort of maintenance on your vehicles today, $200 was a compromise amount that was found in other state statutes. It seems to be reasonable. It seems to be understood by a lot of people as an amount of money that becomes serious for a lot of people if you start going over $200. So that was the compromise, and it helps both the shops and the consumers, we believe. Because, again, if you're going into just drop off your car at a shop and you want oil change and a tire rotation and maybe a radiator flush, $100 or $120, you can do that without having to comply with the authorization requirements of the statute. One of the other points that I'd like to make is the only similar requirement right now that exists in Oregon law is under the insurance code. It's Chapter 746. It has to do specifically with auto body and frame repair shops. Because that similar requirement exists, because those shops already have certain statutory mandates they have to follow with, this dash one amendment specifically removes those shops from the requirement of this bill. And that was the intent, really, of the original bill, that day-to-day maintenance and repairs didn't have that requirement that exists for auto body repair or auto body and frame repair shops, and so it's also an equalizer, not just a consumer protection measure. Last, I'd like to mention that one of the other issues that came up were fleets and business vehicles. The dash one amendments make clear that the statute applies to personal use vehicles, to consumers' vehicles as they're viewed under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which generally exempts business to business type transactions. So, and the original introduced version did place a mechanism for both the Attorney General and private parties to enforce through the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. That remains. And, of course, if you have any further questions, we're welcome to answer them. There are some industry signed up, and they may be able to answer some more questions specific to them as well.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Wingard.
Thank you. Andrew Keith, just help me understand that if I drop my car off, and the estimate's $1,000, and I'm at work, and they call me and say it's going to be another $500. do we have to do some kind of paper exchange? Can I give authorization on the phone, or do we, I mean, and you were talking about modern technology, could they send me either a text or an email in which I reply and approve, and now they have essentially written authorization for me?
Chair Holby, Representative Winger, absolutely, and I was giving you the abbreviated version to be nice to the committee, but I can get into a little more specific.
You don't have to get.
I'll try not to get into too many specifics.
I have to live with these people, so
yes.
You don't.
As it would be amended by the dash ones, the bill. What it requires is that the shop create an estimate or a document before they begin the work. It does not require that you as the consumer see that or that the shop provide you that written document before they do the work. It's just that they have to provide you that information and you have to okay that information. And yes, there are specific mechanisms in the bill that allow you to do that orally, so they can call you up, tell you what it's going to be, tell you what the work is that they are going to perform, and then you can okay that orally over the telephone. And then there are certain requirements where they have to put notations and who they talk to and what time they talk to it on that written estimate that they have back at the shop. You can also do it with facsimiles, and we also foresee more and more shops doing it by email today for those consumers who have email access.
Which is better than oral.
Absolutely. And again, if the consumer chooses, if those authorization rights are provided to them and explained to them, the consumer can choose to waive that if you're a busy representative and you trust your shop and you don't want to be bothered.
Thank you.
Appreciate the testimony, and appreciate you taking this bill back to the industry and working out the details in a diligent fashion.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Next up, I have Tom Gallagher and Daryl Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Auto Dealers. We do appreciate working with the Department of Justice on this bill and think that we have a pretty good bill here. A couple of the concerns of all our operation is customer communications and good business practices, all of which are reflected in this bill. The things that we've agreed to do and that this bill provides for us to do just make good common sense. We don't perceive this bill to be overly burdensome. Thanks to technology, almost everybody now has the computers and machinery that will handle this stuff and make all of these notations electronically, and it should work fairly smoothly. Again, we appreciate working with DOJ here, and we support the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association. Our association represents both collision and mechanical repair shops. We worked with the Department of Justice. They were very, very helpful in walking through the bill and allowing us to explain how their intent would be translated into business practices. And we were able to make some adjustments to the bill that still protect the consumer without overly burdening shops that are already doing business the right way. We support the Dash 1 amendments. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you, gentlemen. And committee, I appreciate that we have another, what seems like a non-controversial bill to make Representative Krieger happy. And
are we in work session?
No, we're not.
No.
Would you like to be?
I see that step coming.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
That'd be a good one. I will get them done.
Mr. Chair.
I will open a work session on House Bill 2268.
Mr. Chair, I'd make a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2268.
Representative Wingard makes a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2268. Discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to offer some advice to my good friend on the end. Do not put any more money in that car of yours.
And and that's pertinent to the Dash 1 amendments, I would assume?
It's not. I apologize.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any objections to adopting the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted to House Bill 2268.
Mr. Chair.
With that, I'm going to, before you say another word, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2268. As a result, we don't have the fiscal to move this bill, but now the fiscal department will know what we want to do.
Oiled again.
And I'd like to carry this bill over until Friday. Is that correct? Friday.
Yes, sir.
With that, colleagues.
I was trying to up the production level.
Yeah. Have something that says move this.
With that, I'd like to open the. With that, I'm going to recess for about 2 minutes. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection back to order. Thank you very much, committee. And with that, I'd like to open a public... I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2680. Victoria, would you please give us a brief description of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2680 prohibits the sale, transfer, or exchange for commercial purposes of prescription drug information that identifies either a prescriber or a patient.
Thank you. And Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Chair Holby and members of the committee, I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative representing Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. I'm here to testify in strong support of House Bill 2680, which would prohibit the use and sale of prescription drug information that identifies the prescriber or the subject of a prescription drug order. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, computer technologies made data regarding prescriptions and physicians readily available through databases. This helped jumpstart a new marketing technique that allowed pharmaceutical companies to buy prescription records from pharmacies and other intermediaries. Today, companies compile massive databases containing the prescribing habits of millions of physicians and prescribers across the country. They analyze data to display sale trends, classify a prescriber's brand use, and to see exactly how much a physician or a prescriber is prescribing in general. Once these databases are mined, pharmaceutical companies can use the information they obtain to guide sophisticated marketing techniques. For instance, if they see that a certain doctor is more prone to using new drugs, the marketers can intensively target that doctor with any new medication their pharmaceutical company comes out with, while also possibly rewarding that doctor. If a doctor is not adequately prescribing their medications, they can reevaluate their sales promotions to better tailor their campaign to an individual doctor's needs. One example of a company actively involved in the data mining process, Dendrite International, touts the benefits of its data mining product as a comprehensive marketing tool capable of providing physician-level insight to assist in the return of all channels of promotion. Additionally, their marketing brochure states, "Now pharmaceutical manufacturers who partner with Dendrite can gain a level of insight that allows them to predict and influence physician prescribing behavior like never before." I've attached a copy of the home page of their website for your convenience. You have to sort of glean what they're saying. It's pretty subtle in the statements that they make. Dendrite is one of many similar companies involved in this lucrative process. And when I say lucrative, we're talking billions of dollars. And I hope it gives the members of this committee an idea of exactly how this process takes place. Colleagues, data mining presents a wide array of problems. Most importantly, the strategies pharmaceutical representatives use after data mining allow for unnecessary influence of the prescribing practices of many physicians. This, in turn, can contribute to unreasonable prescribing of the newest and most expensive medications, ultimately raising the cost of health care for us all. We, the sponsors of this bill, recognize that prescription data is often needed for research purposes, but targeting individual prescribers has adverse effects and allows for undue influence by pharmaceutical marketing representatives. This bill addresses the negative aspects of marketing while also raising awareness about the potential effects data mining has on consumers. I would urge that you move this bill forward with the new pass recommendation, and thank you to the committee for hearing my testimony on this important bill, and I'm open for any questions that I may be able to answer. Representative Gillian, have I touched you to the heart? Good.
Representative Gillian, a question?
No.
Any questions of our colleague while she's down there in the hot seat? Representative Tomei, I think you presented the purpose of this bill well, and it is an area of concern, I believe, and I appreciate you helping bring this bill forward.
Great. I think there will be some representatives here from the pharmaceutical companies, and I think one of their concerns is that they want to be able to alert physicians if a bill has been determined to be dangerous, and that's certainly inappropriate. But there are other ways of alerting physicians. There are alerting materials that all the pharmaceutical companies have access to that they can alert physicians across the board, and it should they don't need, in other words, this information about who prescribes what drug. Whatever concerns that they have about the danger of using a particular drug for a particular reason can be sent out to all physicians, and it should go out to all physicians, not just people that they have targeted as prescribing this medication.
Thank you. Representative Widener, a question?
Yes. Thank you, Chair and Representative Tomei. You kind of prompted, I was going to wait on this question, but it looks like you've done some of the research.
Right.
One of the things that we just had happen, because it's not only pharmaceuticals that do this, but it's also different stores, Safeway, all the grocery stores, Costco.
Right.
And Costco, when the peanut butter outbreak happened, they notified everybody and knew everybody who had bought peanut butter from them. So this issue goes way beyond this because it's part of marketing, and that's what's became the sales and marketing today is how do you grab information, and it's getting cards in people's hands. So I think this is going to be a real tough issue to address because it's going to affect a lot of industries and something we'll have to look at close. I don't know if you took all of that into account when you were bringing this bill forward and look into it.
Well, it's much narrower. I think what the Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I think what you're addressing is certainly a widespread issue. This is just a pretty narrow issue. It only describes a very narrow part of the industry. But it seems to me that you bring up a very important issue. If what drugs I take, if that isn't my private information between me and my physician, what could be more private? So it seems to me that this addresses a very important issue around privacy and safety.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
One of the things would be like if, let's say a generic came out on the market and you're having to pay $300 and you can go to $30 in payment. That's where having this information for the marketing, I can see being very powerful because now they can notify your doctor, hey, she could be eligible for this drug here and replace.
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, my guess is that they would not be alerting you that a generic is available. Their interest is in selling you the very expensive drug.
The people who make the generic would be interested in getting that to the doctor.
Well, certainly, but that, Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, that information should be available to all physicians.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions for you, Representative. It's my understanding that there is currently an opt-out provision on this program, that doctors and the AMA has informed them of that opt-out program. Are you not satisfied with that program,
no,
or does your concern go deeper about their ability to do this, even if doctors are given the ability to opt out?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard, thank you for that question. Yes. Actually, the information is available even if a physician has opted out, and only a very small proportion of physicians opt out. They may be aware of it. I think it's something like less than 10%, maybe 5 or 6%, and we can ask if OMA is here to testify. But also, I would point out that the oil makes millions of dollars on providing this service to the pharmaceutical companies. So if they come before us, you might ask them exactly how much they get from that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Representative, if the doctors are aware of this opt-out and 5, 6, 10%, whatever the number is, are choosing not to opt out of this program, should we be concerned about why it is that the vast majority of them want to continue to remain, to have this information available?
Chair Hovland, Representative Wingard, that's a good question, and I don't have a really good answer for it, except that I think that most of them just don't take the opportunity to opt out. But I'm not exactly sure of that. I just know that a very small proportion do. However, when there is a poll that is in this information somewhere that shows that when physicians are polled and asked, should this information be available to the pharmaceutical companies, and they say no. But why they don't then take another step and choose to opt out, I'm not sure that I can answer that. Okay, I've been handed. This is in information we got from the Prescription Project, which is in Massachusetts. They said even after physicians enroll in the opt-out, which is the PDRP, the AMA continues to provide their information to data mining companies, number one. The PDRP relies on pharmaceutical companies to check an updated opt-out quarterly and voluntarily halt the release of enrolled physicians' prescribing information to their sales representatives. However, marketing executives may still use the information to create individual prescriber profiles to develop marketing strategies or reward sales representatives. That's why we have staff behind us, isn't it? The PDRP has been poorly publicized and underutilized. Less than 25% of physicians, I was wrong, it was more than I thought, are even aware of the program. About two-thirds of physicians indicated in AMA Gallup poll that they are opposed to their prescribing records being used for drug industry marketing. Yet, less than 2% of all physicians have opted out using the AMA's internet-based system. Isn't that fascinating?
It is fascinating.
And what are you reading that from, Representative Tomei?
From this information, it's called the Prescription Project.
It was created with the
Pew Charitable Trust by the project. It's led by the Community Catalyst in partnership with the Institute on Medicine as a Profession.
Okay.
And I can get all this information to you.
I think I have it in front of me. I was just...
One more follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Winger.
I just want to go back to the point you were making about how if there were some kind of an issue around a drug and the drug company wanted to get out information about that, you had made the point that you think that they should make that broadly known.
Exactly.
But I guess my initial thought when you said that, though, was that if a drug is predominantly prescribed by a small section of doctors, and this is a serious issue, and they want to do more than just blanket inform, they may want to personally visit, they may want to do a real serious follow-up targeted at those doctors who are heavy prescribers of that drug in order to, if we're talking about a serious side effect or, some issue with the drug, being able to gain access to information that would let you target your recall or informant your alert information would just intuitively seem to me to be important for a pharmaceutical company to have, rather than if it's 5% of the doctors that are primarily prescribing this, and they want maybe even to go personally visit or to do extraordinary outreach in order to deal with some emergency situation around this drug. Preventing them from being able to do that and saying you basically have to, your message has to be, blanketed out, I'm not sure that that's in the public's interest when, if they had a list, they could really get at it quickly.
Chair Hovey, Representative Wingard, all I can do is give you my opinion. I guess one would have to weigh that against my right of privacy of not having the information about my drug use available publicly. So also thinking that would be such a small group of people for whom that would be the case, that I'm not sure it would be... certainly that information should be sent out to all physicians, not just those few that are prescribing that particular drug, so that all physicians would know this has dangerous side effects or whatever, so they would not prescribe it. So again, I don't think that that would weigh very much in my viewpoint against my right to privacy.
One last question. I just want to be clear. We're talking about a system that allows pharmaceutical companies to see what you, Carolyn Tomé, have prescribed, or are we talking about a system that allows them to see how much of a drug a doctor is prescribing and which doctors are prescribing the drug? In other words, is this a system that allows them to track what doctors are doing or what you, Carolyn Tomé, are actually getting in the way of drugs? I mean, you can bring up a sheet that says, here's every drug Carolyn Tomé has gotten a prescription for in the last, with your name and information on it?
Chair Hovey, Representative Wingard, I'm not sure. Let me ask my staff.
It's you know the prescriber that?
No, you've got it on me. Well, maybe we could bring him up. Would that be okay, Chair Hovey?
Certainly.
I don't know.
Well, should we vote on it?
Roll call.
Please introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, I'm Rearmitage, staff to Chair Hovey. The bill is specific to prescriber identifiable data, but I do believe that it does have a very strong indirect connection to private individual information, even though that is protected by HIPAA. The way that the information can be used can have a strong effect on how doctors prescribe that, how they prescribe specific types of medicines to an individual. So in a very strong indirect way, Representative Tomei's privacy would be affected, I think, even though this bill is specific to prescriber-identifiable data.
Okay, but her personal information on what she has received is protected by federal law.
Is protected by federal law, but you have to think about the undue influence that that pharmacy reps would have, or do have currently, if they don't, and a very few amount are even aware of that, of the AMA program that doesn't really work that well. Okay. So...
I understand. I just wanted to clarify that her personal prescription habits and records are protected by federal law.
Follow up.
Her privacy rights are not invaded.
Sorry. I wouldn't say that that's entirely correct because indirectly you can still get at that information because of that prescriber identifiable data. I think, yes, specific to her name. Yes, but there's codes that they can use. There's a roundabout process to get at that information. And it does have an effect. This prescriber-identifiable data does have a strong effect on individual and the type of medicines that their doctors are prescribing or not prescribing or over-prescribing because of undue influence from the pharmaceutical industry. So.
And one final point. You're talking about...
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're talking about an effect, and I understand that's a debate, but that is separate from whether or not her personal privacy is invaded. And I'm still under the belief that Representative Tomé and Representative Wingard and everyone in this room's personal medical records, including what prescriptions she specifically is receiving, is protected by federal law.
Yes, you could say that, but I don't think that's entirely accurate. So,
Representative Tomé, to follow up on a previous question, you know, in the instance where Representative Wingard was discussing, you know, having the pharmaceutical companies being able to get the word out about dangerous drugs to patients, I guess, or to doctors, I guess, in under this bill, they're looking at prescribers. This bill doesn't prevent the accumulation of data by the pharmacy itself. And wouldn't the drug companies notify the pharmacies, and then the pharmacies would notify the people that they have written prescriptions for?
Chair Hovey, I think that's accurate.
Thank you. Any other questions for... Or would you like to sit there? Senator Bates has come in. Senator Bates, would you like to testify at this point?
Sure. It's okay if the committee
Certainly.
May I come back up?
Yeah, I suppose you could ask him
roll
questions better
from up here.
Certainly, thank you. Senator, welcome to our committee. It's a pleasure to have you here, and I know you have an extremely busy schedule. I appreciate you coming to testify on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Alan Bates, State Senator from District 3. I appreciate your time also. The Senate's primarily playing golf right now, kind of laying around the sun, kicking back. I'm kidding, of course. We're hammered just like you are. It's a tough session, and I realize your time is short. I'd like to make just a few quick comments about House Bill 2680, then take your questions. In reading the bill and looking at the bill and thinking of my own personal experiences, this seems to be a pretty straightforward issue and one which I think deals fairly with the issues in front of us. I'll give a little background on myself. Before becoming a physician, I worked for Park Davis and Company for almost 5 years as a detail representative. That's part of my life I look back on with fondness and pride. They were a great company to work for, and I thought the job we did as detail people was something that had real value for the health industry, and I still believe that to be true. The issue I keep running into about once a year, much less than I used to, is a detail representative coming to me in my office, not to talk about a drug, but to talk about my prescribing habits, my personal prescribing habits, and that really bothers me. I've had a couple of mice, I had to tell them if you do it again, I'll have to ask to leave the building. And they somehow were getting information about how many prescriptions I was writing of a particular product, which is something that was inappropriate. What is appropriate is that when you're working for a large company and you have a territory you have to manage and have to take care of, your company has a right to know, are you being effective? And if you give them that information based on what your pharmaceutical sales are for your territory, I think that's a very reasonable thing on a territorial basis, not on the basis of individual physicians. And this bill, I do not believe, prevents that from happening. In fact, I wouldn't want that to stop happening. I think that's a legitimate job that's being done by detailed people, and I think it should be continued. What this also does, and I think the word commercial is very important in this, is there are times when a drug company, a pharmaceutical industry, will tell us something about a particular drug that is a problem, and we need to be able to contact our patients and let them know that they should stop taking the drug, change the dosage, or there's other problems involved. It's not just as simple as that often. You often don't know yourself which patients have those drugs if you haven't got the proper electronic medical record and you have to track them, but that's a different issue. They do need to have information available through the pharmacies or other ways of dispensing drugs that have some idea what patients are taking. And as you pointed out, Representative Weingard, that is protected information under HIPAA. Okay, but still, for patient safety at times, getting that information back out to patients to stop a drug, to change a dosage in a drug is important. I don't believe this bill stops that from happening. This is just strictly about commercial use of that database, and it's one I think that I can support, would like to support. I also think most legitimate, I shouldn't say legitimate, that's probably not the right word, most highly ethical pharmaceutical companies in this day and age do not go into this data and come to individual physician. It used to be a pretty regular thing 15 years ago. It's very rare now, but I want to put an end to the practice entirely. I think it's unfair to those who are playing by the rules. I think it's in a position on a physician to have that kind of pressure put on them about what pharmaceuticals they might be or might not be writing. So I'll stop there, and if you'd like to ask any questions, I'm glad to answer it for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I've got one that just keeps bothering me a little bit as far as this prescriber identifiable information, whether or not it's necessary for, I guess, the protection of the patient, whether or not they're taking the most appropriate drug or there's new information about a drug that comes out. You know, how does that process and that information efficiently get to either the pharmacy and back to the physician so they can, you know, bring that information or change the prescription of a patient? And I'm worried about whether or not this bill would have a negative impact on that process.
Well, I'll tell you first off that the answer to your question is not very well. Okay, if you have an electronic medical record system that tracks by prescriptions your patients, you get the button and it'll print out and you'll know the list of patients who are taking that medication. Many of us do not have that yet. We're working towards it. Some do and some don't. Oregon's one of the most highly penetrated states in the union on this, but especially in primary care, it's still a pretty low number, although we're working towards it. So having said that, I would tell you it's not a very efficient system. I don't believe this bill will change that in a negative fashion. That database will still be there. It's fragmentary. Some pharmacies, I believe, keep it. Some don't. If I had a recall of a drug recently about a year and a half ago, and we tried to decide how we're going to go check our patients on it and get them off the drug and onto something else. And it was a problem basically with a drug that had difficulty in manufacturing and that we didn't know how much the concentration was in the drug. So what did we do? We had to go through our charts by hand looking for patients on this. We called a couple of pharmacies trying to get some feel for it also. Some could help us, some of us couldn't. And we just picked it up as best we could going through that. The drug recall was sent to us by the company involved, and then we had to start backtracking on it. So it's a clumsy system, one we need to fix, one we're going to work on. In fact, we're going to electronic medical record in my office as soon as this session's over. My staff didn't want to do it while I was up here. So that is a good question, but I don't think this will affect it. My reading of the bill says nothing changes. You just can't mine this data for commercial purposes. And for legitimate purposes, I think it should remain.
So, and to follow up on my own question, because I know this happened to me, and it was actually my pharmacy that called me because they kept all that data on the prescriptions that they filled from my doctor, and they just called me up and said, there's a problem with this drug, you need to contact your doctor, and it was interesting that they contacted me before my doctor did.
Better database. And, and if you have commercial insurance, we have that kind of information on you also. And to a great degree, the managed care plans in Medicaid have it too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fragmentary system, I admit. It's not the best. But I don't think this bill affects it.
So does this bill affect insurance plans then with the same way about transferring that to... Or is that an issue?
From my knowledge, it's not an issue. You'd have to ask the pharmaceutical industry that. I don't believe it's an issue. I would imagine they go to the pharmacies for their information, and they know which pharmacies are shipping to and how much are shipping to. So they know the market share they've got in most areas. Some of it, however, is shipped through pharmacies that they can't track. They might be sending it through a wholesaler in one part of the state or a wholesaler from the hell of many states, so tracking out in individual territories becomes more difficult for them. And you'd have to ask them those questions. I can tell you in the long gone days when I did it, they knew what my sales were in my territory and we talked about it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Other questions for Senator Bates? You have an opportunity to ask a doctor, colleague.
No medical questions, please.
Almost at the mic.
I got this thing here.
Got a mole.
I won't ask you about the bait call that I was taking, but...
That was one of our recalls, right?
So, yeah, the one I was speaking of. Representative Widener.
Just one real quick question, because I don't know if we have any other doctors in here, but Senator, is this more an aspect of getting... salesmen, so they're not calling on you so much, because when they know what you're prescribing, it's like, hey, how come you're using Joe over here rather than me for this product?
I don't think so. I actually enjoy talking to detail reps, maybe because of my background, but I often ask them questions that they'll send back to the company and get me really good information back on. I don't take part in lunches or anything else with them. It's strictly a relationship of getting information, and they can really get me good information sometimes. So we can have some wonderful conversations about the value of new medications coming out or the lack of them sometimes, or what's the gain. So I don't think so. This is just one part, this little part of the practice. It just gets my goat, to be honest about it, and it needs to be ended. I mean, they shouldn't be coming in saying, I know how much of this you're writing. I'm coming in not writing more of it. Most of them did not do that. Only get it about once a year now. It's rare. And most of the pharmaceutical companies say you shouldn't be doing that. They shouldn't be. You shouldn't have that information on your doctors, and you shouldn't be talking about it. It's just nurse practitioners too, of course. So I don't think so. Yeah, I enjoy my relationship with my detail people. Okay?
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and your perspective from being a prescriber on this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and many members, thank you for your time.
And have a good time with the golf and whatever activities you guys do over there.
Bowling league with the room they got over there.
You know, I know the Senate has some pretty large spaces over there. I just didn't know they had an indoor golf arena.
In comparison to yours, we have putting greens in our offices, you know, and
bowling
you guys got, you know, road rules.
Well, we can talk about that later.
Hold the sound arms. It's time for him to go.
Next up, I have Representative Jim Thompson. Or you're coming up with a few other people. Is that I'm trying to read these notes? Or are you coming up separately?
I have separate? No idea. I can't.
No, I guess not. I guess you're coming up by yourself.
I'm not opposed to coming up with other people. But
yeah. I was trying to read the hieroglyphics here.
Yeah,
so.
Wasn't given that memo. So
okay, neither was I. So. Welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Chair Hovey, for the record, my name is Jim Thompson. I'm State Representative for House District 23. More germane to this topic, I spent 25 years in pharmaceutical research, and I was part of the Bayer Baycol recall that you mentioned, so been there, done that. One of the concerns I have about this bill, I understand the concern about using this information for marketing, advertising, et cetera, purposes, but I'm a little bothered by the word commercial, because one of the real reasons to have this information is pharmaceutical research. And we've already established, I think, pretty well that patient-specific information is protected by HIPAA. So if anyone is getting that information about an individual, they're in violation of the law. Secondly, we're not going to stop the collection of data, because the data we're concerned with is mined or is accumulated in silos throughout the country, generally outside the state of Oregon. So it's not just a state territorial problem, and for a whole lot of different purposes. I mean, for instance, if you got into the Walgreens computer system anywhere in the country, you would have access to the prescription records of every Walgreens patient everywhere else in the country. So the information's already there. So what we're really dealing with are the companies that have permission to mine that information for overall kinds of patterns, not patient-specific, and then what's done with that information. One real application that I think could be damaged with this is the business of clinical trials for new medications or new uses of existing medications, where you need to be able to identify patients with certain characteristics. And this can sometimes become pretty involved. For instance, if I were a company developing an improved blood pressure medication that might be indicated to be used alongside of an existing medication in order to get better outcomes, in order to do FDA clinical trials for that, I would have to identify patients that were taking the existing medication in order to build a population that I could run a clinical trial with my new medication. I would typically do that by contacting one of the medical information companies, and I would have them identify for me a number of doctors regionally, or however I'm dividing the study up, and I would ask them to provide me with the names of doctors who have numbers of patients, preferably larger numbers, it's more efficient that way, on this existing medication. Then I would contact those doctors, and I would pay for that information. And I would ask them to look at their patients. And I'm doing a clinical trial. I need patients who are on the existing medication, don't have other competing types of ailments, and maybe a list of other conditions. I would pay a physician then to look through their patient records and identify patients for me that fit that set of parameters. Then the doctor would notify those patients and say there is an opportunity to take part in a clinical trial of a new medication, and you have the necessary parameters to do that. It's entirely up to the whim of the patient whether they elect to take part in that trial or not. And at that point, I don't even know who they are, because only the physician would have that. Out of that effort, I need to identify a population of hundreds or sometimes thousands of patients that meet these parameters, and that's going to be many, many doctors I'm working with. It's a very, very expensive process. And I'll get a pool of patients large enough to be able to run the clinical trial. I'll either run that clinical trial through a medical school, which is why I might want to mine doctor data only for Portland, because patients in Roseburg aren't going to drive to OHSU to take part in the trial. Or I may actually contract with the physicians individually to do these, depending on the nature of the trial. And therefore, I could spread it out farther. But the trick is I have to have X number of patients, and which is a fairly large number, who meet the parameters I need for my study. And I'm afraid that with disallowing the purchase of this kind of information, that would jeopardize these kind of trials. The flip side is, and you see it occasionally in the Oregonian and whatnot, some clinic in Portland that specializes in clinical trials is going to do a trial on some depression drug that's not out yet. So you'll see an ad, you know, do you feel depressed today? Do you feel like killing yourself every time it's cloudy or some of these things? And if so, fill out this coupon and send it in, and we'll decide if you're a candidate for the clinical trial.
Send me one.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the problem. About 98% of the people who fill out those questionnaires and send them in don't fit the parameters, because everybody feels depressed sometime.
Let's just hope it's not 98% of this committee.
Yeah, right. So that really increases the cost of doing this kind of research in having to sort through a very, very large number of nuisance patients. I mean, the patients aren't a nuisance, the act is a nuisance. So I think there are valid reasons why you might want to have this kind of, or not close this down totally. And of course, I'm leaving the wording up to you people, because you get paid the big bucks. But another reason is doing disease management studies, and that's done by government. If I want to know what the prevalence of high blood pressure is in different parts of Oregon, I can mine this data and see where the patients are taking the medication. If I have an unusually high percentage of patients in Klamath Falls, for instance, on blood pressure medication as compared to Salem, that might be indicative of something. And I can get that kind of information this way. Otherwise, I have no way of finding that. I mean, there's no registry of everybody ever diagnosed with high blood pressure is going to be on this list. We oftentimes do it through the prescription drug mining basis. And sometimes it's even more complicated than that, because we're looking for rather serious diseases. Who's being treated for some pretty serious things all over the country? And you may end up with 5,000 patients for the entire nation that fits a certain parameter you're looking for. But to find those patients, you mine them on the basis of the medications that would be used to treat that particular disease. There's just no other way to find them. And of course, that's statistical beyond that, because there's always some patients who don't get treatment, and hopefully it's not a deadly disease, or you don't need those names, but too late. But excuse me, I'm getting over the capital crud, and it's taking a while. Another reason, and this is, again, the more esoteric, but remember a number of years ago there was a case in the Midwest where a pharmacist was diluting cancer treatment, and he went to prison for it. That kind of a case is oftentimes, thank you, is oftentimes adjudicated by mining, because you would have to go through a pharmacy record or the records of all the pharmacies that pharmacist possibly worked in to find all of the patients that were prescribed a certain thing, the product that was being diluted, and who they are. And, you know, again, that's one of the more esoteric things. My concern is, by taking a broad brush on something like this, you may be going beyond the marketing edge and getting off into some other legitimate reasons. Don't know if you can define a difference between marketing and commercial or not, but I think the message I want to leave you with, there are valid reasons to mine this data. There are valid reasons for people to want to purchase that data, including government agencies doing regional disease management studies. And making the data off limits, I don't think would serve an overall good purpose. And probably somebody right now is mining pneumonia data trying to find me, but you never know.
Thank you. I really appreciate you coming forward with your expertise on this issue. I just have a quick question.
Sure.
For you. You know, and this bill talks about prescriber identifiable information.
Yeah.
And it seems like, as I'm listening to this, and I guess we'll get the some of the industry people up in a minute, it seems like that this information, is at a pharmacy level, and it seems like the information you're talking about you could get from a pharmacist without identifying the specific prescribers of the information.
I don't think that's probably practical, because the pharmacy systems are not easily mineable at a pharmacy level. That's a more difficult way to do it. All the data, most of us deal with chain pharmacies today, and when they fill your prescription, they pull up your screen, they fill a prescription, enter the data, and hit the go button. That information goes to Medicaid here in Salem for reimbursement, your insurance company if you have one, or a number of other places that it needs to go, and it's siloed there. That's the place to get the data. I suppose if you really wanted to go into a pharmacy and search their computer, you might be able to find that, but you'd also, when you pull up the data record, you'd pull up the name of the patient at the same time. I think it's not until that data for the individual patient purchase pattern gets into the silo that you could really pull it out without. And I'm sure there's data people here going to tell you about that.
Well, it seems like the pharmacy would be able to redact that prescriber and patient information, potentially.
Pharmacies are fairly busy, and I doubt if they'd want to do it, frankly.
Yeah.
You'd have to pay them dearly, but it's not something that pharmacies don't deal with data in that way, as in data reports. They deal with this prescription goes into the computer and goes wherever it needs to go in the filing system, but it's not something they would
routinely. I just say that because I know my pharmacy has that information, because they're able to contact everybody they've written a prescription for.
Right. They can do it by drug, and they can search for a drug.
Anyway, I appreciate it. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, thanks for coming, especially when you're obviously not feeling well. I know you've read the bill, but it seems like it's pretty specific. Commercial purpose means advertising, marketing, promotion, any activity that could be used to influence sales or market share of a pharmaceutical product.
Well, that's the part that bothers me, because when you get into I don't think that part is specific enough. If I'm doing a clinical trial on a new product, I'm moving toward intending to influence somebody with my new product. I mean, I'm proving the fact that my new product is better than the competitors, and I'm going to use that data to show that. Or I'm proving that my product supplementing one that's on the market is a better choice for people. So the line between the using the data to prove a research point that then is going to be immediately used in a marketing context, I'm not sure where that is. I'm not saying you're wrong. I think there's a fine line there we need to be very careful of. If it's purely marketing, purely advertising, and there's a way to define that, but when we get off into these, whether or not the data has implications for the next thing over, that's where the line becomes a little fuzzy.
Follow up? Thank you. So I think at least three states have passed this, Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire, and they prohibit only marketing uses of prescribed identifiable prescription data. And so they say that that data is available and permitted for healthcare research.
Okay. I'm not questioning. I don't know those.
Yeah.
I don't know those states. I don't know how long ago they did it or what their experience is, but I'm just asking you to, you know, be careful that we don't close. We have a big interest in pharmaceutical research in the state with OHSU, and that would end dramatically if we did something to
but this is,
curtail.
As I said, this material would be available for research.
I'm not questioning you. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
We need to be very clear about that point.
Right.
Yeah.
Any other questions for a good representative?
Well, you know where to find me if something comes up.
I'll wait till you stop coughing.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Trying to keep down on my prescriptions.
Jim, before you go, look.
Nope.
IMS, which is the world's largest aggregator of prescription data, says that sales to the pharmaceutical industry accounted for substantially all of our revenue in the years that they have data for, 04, 05, and 06. Which was almost $2 billion. Yeah. So, and then it says that...
That will be for all purposes, I assume, right?
For purposes to the pharmaceutical industry.
See, that could be clinical studies as well as marketing or anything else.
And it said that data sets sold by health information organizations are cost prohibitive for researchers, and there's very limited use of them for non-marketing purposes.
That's not true, because I have paid dearly for that information in the past, and it's ruinous to a research budget to have to do that. But you know, there are, especially for small companies, and we have a lot of small biotech companies that may have a single product, and that's a huge part of their research budget to set up a clinical trial.
Right.
In fact, it's what busts a lot of small companies, because they can't take it to that step.
And maybe we could ask Representative Thompson to get us information on that. That would be great. Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
No problem.
Thank you.
Next up, I have Randy Frankel, Steve Palmer, and Mr. Isselman. Was he supposed to be up here or down here? Yeah. Welcome. And Mr. Isselman, I don't know if you were intending to be on this panel or the next one.
I can be on any panel you like. Mr.
Well, maybe you ought to ask them if they... No. Come on up.
It would be our pleasure.
Thank you.
So welcome. Good afternoon. And I know you've traveled here from some distance, so I appreciate your patience and appreciate you making the effort to be here. Could I identify yourself for the record, please?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Randy Frankel. I'm Vice President of External Affairs at IMS Health. I'm very pleased to be here, and I hope you invite me back under better circumstances.
Okay, after session's over, when the sun's shining, consider it done.
Shall I begin?
You may.
I thank you again for allowing us to be here today. Unfortunately, I have to say to you, this is the proverbial Gordian knot. There is no simple way of unwinding this to carve out a specific use or conduct without having unintended consequences everywhere else. And as a result, we are here in opposition to HB 2680, and we have a number of reasons for doing it. Overall, we see this as a high-risk bill with virtually low, if any, return on in terms of benefits that would be derived from it. We have a number of reasons for saying that, and I'm sure and hopefully you'll have questions and I'll be able to give you more detail, but I'll start by saying that this is not an issue about individual patient privacy. The laws similar to this have been promulgated in the Northeast. They were founded on the basis that there were issues of patient privacy, physician privacy, and that these data are driving healthcare costs and irrational prescribing of medication. We did go through indeed two federal trials in New Hampshire first and then Maine. Both judges decided that the laws should not be passed. This was Judge Barbadaro in New Hampshire and Judge Woodcock in Maine. Both of them said this was speech. Both of them agreed that there is no patient privacy issue here, that physician privacy, while certainly something that individuals are concerned about, is not part of our framework in this nation, that in their professional capacity, they had no reason to expect privacy because it's the right of the patient to know what people in a professional capacity, a lawyer, an architect, or a physician, are doing and how they're conducting themselves. That allows, you know, review of physician practices, fraud and abuse, and a host of other activities around people in their professional capacity. So I'll start by trying to address one of the issues that continues to come up, and that has to do with patient privacy. IMS is a 54-year-old company or so. We hear that we make billions of dollars, and yes, indeed, the company makes over $2 billion a year. It's also in 106 or so countries. More than half of our revenues come from overseas. The profits and the products that we sell in this country include prescriber-level data, but a host of others, including the nation's largest medical claims database to do outcomes, comparative effectiveness, and a host of other things. We fully expect to be part of the nation's solution with health information technology and comparative effectiveness. Our data will be used for safety and a host of other things in this country and in other nations. If you have a question about whether comparative effectiveness in England compares to comparative effectiveness in New Zealand or Australia, or what we're considering in this country, you would probably come to us. And so this is a global asset that is applied nationally and globally to answer important questions about quality, about cost, about the overall healthcare dynamics that we all know are excessively complicated and difficult to unwind, and managing and reforming will take a constant flow of data to see the consequences and the unintended consequences that result. So I get back to a bill like this, and I have to tell you I've testified in these other states. Only one state has this enacted right now, that's New Hampshire. They did have it enacted for a period of about 9 months from 2006 to 2007. They said it wasn't enough time to measure any impact, which makes me think it's probably not a very large impact, if any, on prescribing. But that said, the nature of this bill and what I'd like you all to consider is the benefits and the risks. The risks here, first of all, have to do with the fact that it's likely to harm patients. Judge Barbadaro in New Hampshire said, even if it could save money, it is unlikely to be able to do it without compromising patient care. Judge Woodcock in Maine said the same thing. This issue wasn't even addressed in the Court of Appeals that overturned that ruling in those two states. And I say it's a risk to patients because if you make the assumption that these data connect someone with a product, with a physician who treats patients who may benefit from it, and then you break that link so that we can't, and that the pharmaceutical industry cannot find those doctors readily, then some of them will be missed. Some patients may get these drugs on a less timely basis than they should. You create, in effect, a withholding period I believe, an unintended withholding period. Now, if you have a teenage daughter, and I've gone through four, I used to be much taller, then I will tell you that if you have a vaccine, Gardasil, for cervical cancer, and you withhold that from a population just because the data aren't available for a period of time, some of those young women will contract that virus. Some of them will go on to develop cervical cancer, and some of them will die. I bring that up because there are drugs you would clearly want to move through the healthcare system as fast as possible. And what you're doing is creating a summary judgment about all new medications. We are going to slow them down by eliminating these data, whether they are good or whether they are simply comparable. Without discriminating between the two, you are likely to harm patients. Second risk is the FDA uses our data. I'll go as far as to say virtually every agency that looks at drugs in the federal government uses our data. But they use it for a specific purpose. You've heard about drugs that are high risk, that have side effects, that can go on the market, but with a lot of extra effort to support safety. And they develop what they call REMS. It's a risk evaluation and management system, which cannot be done without data like this. Because in many cases, it absolutely requires you to go to all doctors who are likely to prescribe it and educate them and monitor them and report on it. Now, that is a commercial purpose. These doctors have to be contacted, but they have to be found. They have to be monitored, and there's no other way to get these data. But in the end, it's going to sell a product. And so you've got post-marketing surveillance, safety, all wrapped up into a commercial undertaking that would certainly be undermined by a law like this. The third is the biotech industry, life sciences. You all have invested very heavily in them. By definition, they have targeted products to populations of less than 20,000 people. So rheumatoid arthritis, for example, Alzheimer's disease, HIV, AIDS, very small populations are in effect a needle in a haystack proposition. Here in the state of Oregon, if you have a breakthrough for Alzheimer's disease, you have 15,004 prescribers. Not physicians, some of them are nurse practitioners, physician assistants, a whole host of specialties. 712 of the 15,004 account for 80% of all the prescribing for Alzheimer's disease. If you're a small company and invested heavily in research, you have a sales force, some cases starting out with 80 or 100 people, there is no way in the world they can cover the 15,000 doctors to get to the 712. If you have an HIV drug in this state, 22 doctors account for 80, 22 prescribers account for 80% of all the prescribing. And they're not all physicians. Nurse practitioners, physician assistants. So you wouldn't be able to identify them by specialty because you may find very, very odd specialties treating. One of the highest prescribers in Washington, D.C. turned out to be a dermatologist. I know that because we're working with the District of Columbia to help them deal with an epidemic of HIV/AIDS. Finding the needle in the haystack for a small company is virtually impossible without these data. Managing risk programs for small biotech companies is practically impossible without these data. So there are huge benefits here and huge risks by not having it. As far as the return on your investment, I dare say that there are no data to suggest at all that this is driving healthcare costs. You'll find in your package a number of graphs that I've included. You'll see a graph here that will show, along with the increase in the use of our data, has been a steady decline in the drug spend, the dollars spent on the pharmaceuticals in this nation, from an 18% growth rate in 1999 to a decline of 1.6% in 2008. So while more sales reps and more data were hitting the streets, sales of pharmaceuticals have been coming down steadily. Now, I'm not saying that this is the only variable involved in doing it, but if it was a direct link And because of this data, people are hiring all these sales forces and are driving all of this irrational prescribing. I don't know how you come up with a graph like this. So you say, what are these data driving? Maybe it's all new products. Let's look at what happens when you look at products that are 3 years old or less. And this is in terms of prescribing. In 2003, they represented 5.7, I think, percent of all the prescribing in the nation. Now it's 1.3. Now, what dynamics are causing newer drugs to actually go down as a percent? Some of it is the fact that there are fewer new drugs. That's why the sales forces grew in the late 90s. There are a lot of new drug applications and a lot of successful drugs at the market. So they added salespeople, and they've used our data. It didn't drive costs. There are other factors involved. Here what you're seeing are the managed prescription programs working. You here in the state of Oregon have the highest use of generic drugs that I have seen anywhere in the nation. 76%. Fourth quarter of last year was up to 78%. The national average is 70. When you have these means in place, you can increase generic utilization. You can cut back on the use of new drugs. But I have to say, new drugs, 3 years or less, 1.3% of the prescribing in this patient. Where is the exuberant overuse of new drugs? Now, if you question this, and you want to have more data, I'll tell you how we put it together and all the data. We get data that represents 70% of all the prescriptions in this nation. We get it by buying it from pharmacies, by pharmacy chains, from nursing homes, so we know what is happening in nursing homes, in hospitals, virtually every sector of the nation so that we can monitor and understand what is happening. In some cases, in the Bronx, for example, years ago, they saw that there was a very high rate of pediatric hospitalizations and deaths due to asthma. They came and asked for our data. We gave it to them. They found the prescribers, the people who were prescribing for the asthma drugs in the pediatric population, developed an education program, went out and did direct contact, and we're able to bring down the rates of hospitalizations and deaths in that population. Can't do that without a physician name. There are some things you cannot do without knowing who you're going to speak with. Now, are there problems with the use of the data? Yes, there are some sales representatives that use it wrong. As you heard today, there aren't that many. It's been coming down because the AMA has done things about it. 2% of the doctors have opted out, but 100% of them know that they can opt out if they need to. Now, yes, it's a 25% awareness rate. AMA has been spending millions of dollars trying to make people aware. You all know what happens when you put an ad in the newspaper. It doesn't do very much for awareness. It's a constant process of raising awareness. But in the poll that the AMA did, while a large number of doctors said they didn't want people to have the data, the large majority of them said, but if I know I can opt out, I'm okay with it, because they have the threat. 2% of doctors opted out, but 100% of reps know they can, and that this behavior is waning, and it will disappear to virtually something that is not... It's important on an individual level, but in terms of driving costs, it's just not happening. Every representative in this country knows they're not supposed to use the data that way, and they know that if a doctor is annoyed, they can opt them out for good. So the industry has tried very hard to deal with the few people who are misusing the data. We need to be able to commercialize it, because without it, we're not going to spend the hundreds of millions of dollars accumulating the data, managing the privacy, and making it available to government, to the medical community, to academics. I have a list somewhere here of over 100 projects we're doing with academic researchers around the country now. And you won't be surprised to hear most of them are for free. There's no money to pay for it in the academic world. So we try to use the data to improve quality. We try and make every stakeholder, or give them all an opportunity to use the data. We provide it to states virtually for free. I mean, we can't do that unless there's an industry, responsible industry, using it to do good and willing to pay for it. So that's the context in which these data are accumulated. Patient privacy is not an issue. We have tens of billions of transactions a year, have not had a breach, have not had a report, have done nothing. So anyone who tells you that we are interfering with patient-physician relationships or that we are putting personal information out on individuals are misled or misrepresenting. We are not doing that and never have. There is no patient privacy issue here. There's an issue about these data need to be available. We are entering into what's called healthcare reform, and people are going to be making decisions, and we will need data to know when we're cutting accurately and when we're doing harm. So with that, I simply leave you with the final thing. The most recent work done with our data, by the way, it's several millions of dollars worth of data that we gave away for free. Dr. David Cutler, the health advisor to President Obama on healthcare reform, is a recent article in Health Affairs. Last week, we signed a collaborative agreement with the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, offering the data free of charge, by the way, to help them deal with the crisis on the island to improve quality and safety and cost. That's what happens with these data. They want to know which doctors are writing what drugs for their purposes, and they're much more powerful than the pharmaceutical industry. So I thank you all very much.
Thank you. I appreciate a rather lengthy but thorough explanation from your industry and what you do. I understand your questions, but, you know, Senator Bates, I know you were here listening to him as being a prescriber and expressing some dismay about his privacy as a provider. And in this state, we have another program that helps protect applicators of pesticides, and we aren't able to identify them specifically, but there is an agency that can do that, but their information is not allowed to be sold. But they're still able to do their research and look at all this data at a perhaps slightly larger scale. And so I guess my question to you would be is it possible for this research, the data, the information to be, and I'm not suggesting that this is a solution, because pharmacies will probably get all upset if I did at the moment, but is it possible to accomplish this same thing without the specific prescriber information in the big database system if you were able to use, say, that intermediate pharmacy level to get the information, and then if there was any kind of contact that needed to be made to the specific prescriber, that it would happen from the pharmacy to the prescriber?
There's a difference between possibility versus effectiveness. Anything is possible. I don't know of any pharmacies that routinely seek doctors out over any kinds of drug interactions, and FDA has done work on the letters they send out, and they have found them to be completely inadequate. They need to use multiple media. One of those, by the way, is the pharmaceutical industry. They've done quite a number of studies internally, and they basically find that a letter to the world is just that. And I can remember several years ago when they found an important drug interaction between people on antidepressants and migraine medication. And the reality was there was a side effect, and letters went out, and that's all that went out. So no one follows up to see what did a doctor do with those patients. And I'm not saying the pharmaceutical industry does it either. I just know that you can't count on the pharmacy industry to do that. They have confounding factors, and they're not equipped. Their procedures aren't oriented in that direction. And I have to say as well, one of the things that I started in managed care as a result of. The Institute of Medicine did a study in 2001 And they said it takes, on average, 17 years for a clinical insight that has been established in double-blind trials to reach a majority of patients in this nation. 17 years. Today, as an adult with a chronic illness, you have a 55-56% chance of being treated according to best practices. If you're a child, it's 46%. Information doesn't just flow. It has no momentum. It's got to be carried. And you have to know who the underperformers are, if you will, or who may benefit from education and management in order to change care. You must have the physician name, or you cannot change behavior.
All righty. Questions?
Yes.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for coming to Oregon. Can you let us know where you came from?
Chair Holvey and Representative Tomei, I came from Connecticut.
Great. Thank you very much. If I may have a couple of questions. So, do you have the bill in front of you there, Mr. Frankel?
I do not.
Could someone maybe pass it to him? Thank you. So if you could look at that and tell me explicitly what you have problems with, that would be very helpful to me.
Only the word prescriber. If you took that out and kept the words, the rest of the words in, we would have no problem whatsoever.
And could you show me what line that is in?
Well, it's second line. Information that identifies, it says prescriber or subject of prescription drug order. We go through enormous pains and procedures to protect patient identity. So we have no issue. We're HIPAA compliant and beyond.
I understand that.
The prescriber information.
Right. So the fact that it's for commercial purpose does not meet your needs. Is that correct?
Well,
you want any prescriber.
As you indicated, as someone had indicated earlier, the commercial would include a host of different things that go way beyond.
If I can read them to you.
Yes.
Advertising, marketing, promotion, or any activity that could be used to influence sales or market share of a pharmaceutical product, influence or evaluate the prescribing behavior of a health practitioner, or evaluate the effectiveness of a professional pharmaceutical detailing sales force. So it is just for commercial use.
That's correct, but in the same process you're talking about, if I had a breakthrough for cancer and I needed these data to get it to the marketplace quickly, you would be prohibiting it. You would not allow me to use the data. So you're not discriminating in this bill between a beneficial use, which is also marketing. It's commercial, but it's something we would all want versus something that has no value in your mind.
Do you think that if there were a cure for cancer, that wouldn't be on the front page of the paper, that everybody would be delighted to look at that and learn about it?
Yes, but I don't believe it would change enough behavior. I can tell you that in the 1990s, ACE inhibitors were found to reduce deaths by 30% and cost by just as much. That was in the 1990s. By 2000, actually, it was in the 1980s. 10 years later, I did a study and found that only 40% of the patients with that illness were actually taking that drug, and half of them were on too low a dose to be effective. That was Wall Street Journal, New England Journal of Medicine, the Archives of Internal Medicine. It was on the front pages of newspapers. 10 years later, 40% of the people, 60% were dying.
Thank you. And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Are you aware that these privacy measures are in effect in some countries in Europe and in Canada? And as far as I know, do you know of any evidence of problems in those jurisdictions?
I do not work internationally, so I would not know. But I am aware that all of the laws around collection of data, as well as the systems that they have, most of them have health information technology systems. They have the medical records, the personal medical records. All of those things have become so automatic in their system that things do diffuse very quickly. That's not true here in the United States.
But they're just not available. That information is not available for a commercial use. That's what I'm saying. It's certainly available for research and physicians, but it's not available for commercial use, is my understanding.
Because the systems are different, I don't know that I would consider them apples and apples.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I want to try to move on to the next testifier if I can. And unless Representative Barton... I forgot.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
You had a question. Go ahead.
I pass. Thank you, though.
You sure?
I insist.
You insist. Okay.
Chair Hawley, for the record, Jack Esselman of Tonkin Torp. I appear before the committee today on behalf of the Oregon Bioscience Association. The Oregon Bioscience Association is a statewide trade association representing over 200 member companies, individuals and organizations, the preponderance of which are small businesses with less than 24 employees. Many of our points, which I've shared with the committee in writing, have been covered by previous witnesses, so I will summarize. Our fundamental concern with this measure is as it relates to its potential intersection with economic development. I'll give you a few quick examples. The biotechnology industry in Oregon is proud to boast a company like SIGA Technologies, which is headquartered in Corvallis. SIGA is advancing a drug candidate that's an anti-infective for smallpox. And as it's been explained to me, drug development relies heavily on interaction with so-called institutional review boards that are committees that approve, monitor, and review biomedical and behavioral research involving humans. To protect the rights and welfare of those subjects. And it's coordinated through the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Health and Human Services. Prescriber data is used by our member companies in part to inform clinical trials and other drug development and translational research activities. We're also concerned by the scope and some of the definitions in the bill that those activities, as they relate to functions performed before institutional review boards could be implicated here. Prescriber data also helps our member companies determine where are efficacious areas for inquiry, where will they get a return for the substantial investment that is required for translational research, taking the compounds that they have and turning those into efficacious drugs. We also, within our membership, have non-pharmaceutical companies, medical device, biotechnology, tool companies. They work with prescribed data to identify hospitals, physicians, research institutions that are likely partners for the deployment of their latest products. So it plays an R&D role outside of the pharmaceutical industry, but related to the biotechnology industry. And finally, it's been mentioned, the prescriber data helps small drug manufacturers locate physicians and patients with unique medical conditions who benefit from small batch, highly targeted pharmaceutical compounds. So with that, I can conclude my testimony and take any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Isselman. Does anyone have questions? Doesn't appear that we have any questions left. I appreciate your testimony and your explanation of the industry and your concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Halsey.
Next up, I have Tom Holt and Jim Gardner. Oh. Good afternoon, and welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Tom Holt. For the record, I'm here representing ASI, which is a mid-sized biotech company. I've submitted ASI's statement for the record, and I'll just touch on a few high points. ASI is a relatively small company, as the industry goes, it's a mid-sized biotech, manufactures some products, has developed and brought to market several products that have orphan drug status, which means that fewer than 200,000 people in the nation would even potentially have a need for the product, and you may not have heard of these. For instance, we have one called, my client has one called Benzel, which treats a very rare form of childhood epilepsy. I did the math on this, and 0.03% of the people in the country even have this condition. The company also manufactures a product called Ontac, which is also a breakthrough product for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a particular type of that that's particularly rare. These are the kinds of products in which it is extremely important to be able to identify who the treating prescribers may be for those conditions so that patients can be reached with important information that if we don't if the company does not have access to that prescriber data, it would become cost prohibitive to do some kind of a shotgun approach to attempt to reach patients who would benefit from these treatments. ASI also has brought to market a product you may have heard of called Aricept that is one of the few treatments available for early Alzheimer's. One of the things that Alzheimer's patients do, and I don't mean this to be humor, but they do forget to get their refills. And so one of the things that ASI does is contracts with pharmacies to do reminder programs to make sure that those patients remain on their therapy. Remaining on their therapy means they can remain in their homes and not go to an assisted living facility or a nursing home. The company never sees that data in terms of patient-specific information. Company compensates the pharmacy for its efforts and its costs in doing those programs, but that benefits the patients when they remain on their therapy. So it's very critical to have access to this data. The companies like ASI do not have access to it. The costs of bringing orphan products such as the ones that my client has to market would be very prohibitive, potentially could even keep those products from getting to market. A company like ASI does not have armies of representatives. They have to be very, very targeted. There are very, very small numbers of people in the field. In some of the product areas, there are no representatives in some states. So we have to know very precisely where to go. Well, that's the theory. Let me take off my client hat a second and just speak to you as Tom Holt's citizen and tell you a very real story about how this data gets used. There's a woman, 85 years old, who has lost eyesight in one eye to macular degeneration. About 2 years ago, she found out through her physician, an eye specialist, that there was a wonder product that had just come to market. That product is called Lucentis. The treatment is to get an eye shot to the eyeball, a round of three treatments over the course of 3 months. That product saved her eyesight. She is not in a nursing home. She is not terrified about losing her eyesight. And last Sunday, she was at home, in her home, to get a call from her granddaughter, my daughter, to wish her happy birthday. That is a very real way that data gets used. If the company that makes that product, that brought that miracle product to market, had not been able to identify her physician as someone who could potentially prescribe that product and save her eyesight, she would now be in a nursing home costing thousands of dollars a month. Instead, she's enjoying a relatively normal life in her home. I thought it would be beneficial to share that story with you, because we've heard the theory, and the theory is correct, that removing access to this data is damaging to patients. So I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Would you like to identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for pharma, and I'm going to have a hard time topping that last presentation. It's very moving. As has been repeated perhaps more times than the committee would like to hear, patient identifiable information is protected by HIPAA. That's not what we're talking about in this bill. We are talking about prescriber data. And the policy issues revolve around the question of the propriety of the use, the transfer of prescriber-level data and its use for commercial and non-commercial purposes. Now, I want to highlight one particular use and then put that up against the language of the bill, the definitional language under commercial purpose. And the definitional language I want to use is on line 7, or evaluate the prescribing behavior of a health practitioner. Evaluate the prescribing behavior. That's within the definition of commercial purpose. Very recently, Congress passed an important reform piece of legislation called the Food and Drug Administration Amendments Act of 2007. And as a part of that, that act authorized the FDA to require what are called risk evaluation and mitigation strategies, or REMS, for certain high-risk medications. And these programs are structured, as was testified previously, they depend critically upon access by the manufacturers to prescriber-level data about the prescribing behavior of health practitioners. Typically, these drugs are subject to potential misuse, over-prescribing, illicit prescribing, even unlawful prescribing, or prescribing for unlawful purposes. Frequently, they are painkillers. They're drugs that can truly be abused. And the way that you guard against that and serve not only the needs of the healthcare system, but serve the needs of the law enforcement system and reduce the risk to public safety is you put in place a REMS program where you monitor that pattern of prescribing. As was noted, that depends critically upon access by the companies, because the manufacturers are the ones that are responsible for doing this and for paying for these monitoring programs. They have to have access to that data, and that comes within the terms of the definition of commercial purpose. So that would frustrate the ability in the state of Oregon to monitor these potentially very dangerous practices that involve high-risk medications that have a legitimate use, but that can also be abused. And there are other safety concerns. As has been indicated, this kind of data facilitates black box warnings to prescribers by the companies. Black box warnings are warnings that indicate special risks that are associated with particular drugs, and they help in the case of a recall. They more efficiently allow the information to get out quickly to the prescribers, and thus I would say significantly enhance patient safety. Now, why is that part of the definition of commercial purpose? Because that could be used to influence the market share of a pharmaceutical product. By definition, when you're pulling it back, that's gonna shape its market share. That's an unintended consequence, I would submit, of this bill. And finally, as has been again fairly frequently mentioned, The AMA PDRP allows physicians to opt out. And, Mr. Chair, I would hope that the AMA's letter to you and the committee is part of the committee's record so that you can have an appreciation of what the AMA thinks of the efficacy of the opt-out provision that it has put in place. I also furnished for the committee's background an excerpt from the Federal Register, which describes the REMS program and specifically shows that it can be retroactively applied to drugs that are already in the marketplace that predate that 2007 Act. And finally, let me take off my hat as pharma lobbyist and put on my hat as lawyer who has litigated and advised clients with respect to the Oregon constitutional provisions, in particular Article 1, Section 8, which is our free speech clause. Just so the committee is aware, if you will turn to the case City of Nissa, which is the case that sort of looks like this, that's in your packet. If you will turn to page 6, with the chair's permission, I'm going to read just a short provision of that relates to the attempt to distinguish between commercial and non-commercial communication or data transmissions. This is a case called Moser versus Frohnmeyer, and it involved a situation where this legislature had attempted to prohibit the use of an automatic dialing and announcing device, an auto dialer, to solicit the purchase of any realty, goods, or services. The court held that was directed at expression. And the court held that insofar as the law was applicable only to those messages soliciting commercial services or goods, but did not apply to any other type of message, the law restricts expression because it is directed at a specific subject of communication, excluding some speech based on the content of the message. In other words, the very fact that the law targeted commercial speech and excluded non-commercial speech was what rendered that law invalid under Article 1, Section 8. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
A question.
Sir.
The letter from AMA that you were referencing, can you show us what letter you're referring to?
This one, Mr. Chair, it's dated March 18th. It is to yourself, Mr. Chair, and it says Ray, House Bill 2680. I can furnish copies if you don't have it. I think it was sent electronically.
Yeah, I got it by email, but it seemed like it came to all of us.
Would it be helpful, Mr. Chair, if I got you copies of it?
Well, if it was sent email, I get hundreds of emails,
right.
So they're not up to the hour. So
I can make the committee copies.
Did you send one to the committee administrator?
I did not. No, I didn't send it. They did.
Okay. Well, that explains why I don't have it. But thank you. I'm sure we'll track it down.
Yes, sir.
Questions? From the committee of these two panelists. Not seeing any, I really appreciate you coming forward and offering your points of view and providing us with some other information to look at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I have one more testifier signed up, Laura Etherton.
How would you characterize them? Mostly fan mail or complaints?
In the context of this bill?
No.
Thank you. Well, good late afternoon. Thank you for being here. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm an advocate with OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization here in Oregon. And thank you, Chair Holsey and members of the committee, for examining this very important issue today and allowing me the time to speak. OSPIRG, as you know, is a group that works to protect the public interest, to stand up for the public interest, and in particular has worked on consumer protection issues, both on the high costs that consumers face in a number of areas in the marketplace and also on quality issues. Prescription drugs is one of those issues that intersects. It's important for prescription drugs to both be reasonably affordable for people to obtain and for the quality and safety to be assured. Prescription drugs, I want to be crystal clear on this, are something that we think have a really important role to play in helping patients stay healthy to prevent more dramatic and worse outcomes further down the road. And prescription drug companies have done a good job of developing many of those life-saving prescription drugs and many of those drugs that help people manage chronic diseases. This particular bill looks at a practice which is inappropriate. The sale specifically for commercial use of prescriber information for the purpose of influencing physicians to prescribe specific medications for the benefit of that prescription drug company. And I think today we've heard a number of compelling cases for why you would want to have good information about what prescription drugs are being prescribed, and even down to the physician level for research to notify consumers about the increasing problem of safety hazards and recalls regarding prescription drugs. These are important uses. It's important, however, to note that the primary purpose for selling this information to drug companies is so that drug companies can, in a completely reasonable fashion, do what they can to best sell their product. That's in their interest. That's perfectly normal. However, when it comes to sharing that information on a prescriber by prescriber level, it really does give a pharmaceutical company undue influence on what exactly those drugs are that prescriber is prescribing. And I think it's important for us to be clear that many of these drugs, if you're a drug company, you'll be focusing on shifting and driving sales and prescribing toward the most expensive brand name drugs that you have. And that is how, in fact, this practice does drive up the cost of prescription drugs. As we've seen in reviewing the increasing cost of health care, increasing medical costs, and increasing prescription costs, both in utilization and rates, are some of the key drivers to the rising cost of health care, as we see as insurance companies file rate increases. Rising costs of prescription drugs is almost always one of the key reasons they give for that. So we're concerned. We want to make sure, both for quality and for cost reasons, that really it is the physician, the nurse practitioner, whatever prescriber is doing the job, that they are basing their prescribing on the best evidence they have available, and that the pharmaceutical industry fulfills its role in developing and marketing these medications, but draws back before making that physician-to-physician push, which in its broad scale and in most of its uses is inappropriate and driving up costs. I want to, in addition, call your attention to the fact that the similar law that was passed by New Hampshire, if not identical, has actually been upheld by the First Court of Appeals. It was challenged, I believe, on some of the free speech concerns that you heard just a moment ago. It was upheld, and its specificity, drawing that line between commercial and non-commercial, was not an issue because this particular activity is not actually considered speech. So it becomes irrelevant, that line between the two, according to those First Court of Appeals judges in their ruling. So I wanted to note that. Finally, I believe that this bill, in its careful definitions, does a good job of protecting legitimate uses in terms of research and improving the quality and reducing the cost of health care. But certainly, Osberg would be open to whatever we can do to make this bill most clear in its intention regarding the use of this information, the better. But I think that the language you have here is quite clear and sufficient. So wanted to note that as well. I'll keep it short. I think you've heard the major pieces about the pros and cons of this bill, so I'll keep it brief. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Winger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First a comment, then a question, Laura. I think that the point that was being made about the speech protections is more related to how liberally, let's use that word, how liberally the Oregon Supreme Court interprets speech. So a ruling in New Hampshire is not really germane to the point I think that was being made, and I think Oregon Supreme Court has a history of very widely and broadly interpreting the free speech laws. I think we all know the example that I am inclined to share, but the point is it's quite broadly interpreted, and the point was on commercial speech falling into that, which I tend to agree would probably be where the court would go. But I want to get my question is this issue of undue influence or pressure that happens on doctors theoretically. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, it's one thing to come and ask for protections for low-income people who maybe don't have a lot of education, who may be being taken advantage of by, you know, highly skilled professionals. But we are talking about people with advanced degrees and who I would not only expect due to their education and history can defend themselves against the machinations of a pharmaceutical rep, but who I would expect to be able to do that, since these are people who are going to operate on my brain or potentially prescribe medications to me. And if a doctor cannot handle a pharmaceutical rep in their office, I have concerns about their ability to practice medicine. And I would also draw a connection very similar to this relationship is what we see in this building. We have lobbyists who visit us, and we often get accused as elected officials of, well, lobbyists have too much influence on you. And when in reality they're coming to educate us, and we don't always agree with them, and we often take meetings with lobbyists and hear them out and don't do what they'd like us to do. I would hope that with my meager BA and my ability to stick to my beliefs and do what I think is best for my constituents, that a doctor is fully capable of hearing out a pharmaceutical rep and resisting their pressure and doing what's in the best interest of a patient when it comes to prescribing pharmaceuticals.
Chair Hulvey and Representative Wingard, I absolutely agree with you. The expectation is for physicians to prescribe the very best medications and treatment for their patients, to do so with the best evidence that's available. Unfortunately, I do think we hear too often from physicians, from nurse practitioners, of the astounding amount of pressure in subtle and sophisticated ways, whether it's through direct efforts or through withdrawal of other supports that we've seen, that's a concern. And this is not a bill that bans detailing. This is not a ban. It says, in that interaction, is it fair for drug companies to have such detailed information to know not only how that specific prescriber, how much they are prescribing that exact medication, whether you know, the lunch for the office staff helped, or if it was better to court them in a different way. But that's an important piece there. I think one of the pieces, and I'm just actually, I have a copy of some testimony offered by man whose last name I'm forgetting briefly. Meredith Jacob from American University, who has been contacted by a number of physicians saying that they, they've even been told that they, by different company reps, that they will, they'll not support educational programs that that doctor is involved in because they don't do enough prescribing of a specific drug. And that's, I think that's an area where it's gone over the line, and it gets to a point where to protect patients and protect against the high cost of prescription drugs, that this is an appropriate step to take.
Representative Widener.
Just one last quick question, because Laura, you were mentioning the fact that they market higher end drugs and everything with this, but don't you see the company that's making the generic, is this a quick way for them to get their information out so now low income people can afford to buy a drug that they may not have been able to afford before because it was too much, if they had a copay or may not have had a copay, that way the generic can get to market quicker?
Representative Holday and Representative Widener, I think you raise a really important question, which is the availability of generic drugs is an absolutely key way to make sure that all of us can afford prescription drugs that are, you know, therapeutically equivalent. That's a very important piece. Currently, in Oregon, the generic drug can be substituted for a brand name drug if available. So that's an important piece there.
The brand name drug comes first. The generic comes later after the patent's up.
Exactly. So it can be substituted at the pharmacy level if available. I think it's interesting your question about whether generic companies are using this data, and I frankly don't know the extent to which that data is used, and whether it is successful at pushing it in the other direction.
As someone who's done a lot of sales and marketing, I can guarantee they are.
Representative, that would be great for you to research to see if you could find any.
I will get that for you. I'm sure there's people sitting back there waiting to tell me.
Great. Any generics, right? That's what you're looking at, generics, to see if generic companies are looking at this availability of using this process, right?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
I think I'll weigh in here. Any other questions?
I got a quick one, Mr. Chair, if I can.
Okay. Representative Gilliam.
Thanks for being here. This intersection between marketing and healthcare is a tough one, and I'm sure it's a very long and, you know, sometimes wonderful and ugly road that we've come. But you start with some pretty broad statements in your testimony, so I guess my quick question to you is, do you think that 2680, if we passed it, would bring the cost of prescription drugs down in the state of Oregon?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, I think it very much might. I don't, however, believe it's a silver bullet or the only thing that the Oregon legislature should look at. And I applaud this committee and many of the committees in this building for looking at a broad package of bills to help make health care, including prescription drugs, more affordable for Oregonians.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you for staying here at this late hour. And I don't see anyone else left to testify, committee, but I do want to make sure that we do recognize for the record the letters submitted from, as Laura mentioned one already, from the American University, Meredith Jacob, from Express Scripts, David Dietrichs, Oregonians Health and Security, and Tom Cantor. I don't know if I missed any. I'm sure Representative Schaffler will be proud of this committee for the amount of paper we've received today. It certainly is a lot of material for us to look at on this issue, and I'd appreciate you giving it your attention.
So with that, we will be having a meeting on Friday, as you probably already know. We have House Bill 2804, Senate Bill 328, House Bill 2658, and a bill that we've carried over from today, which I don't remember their name, but no, 2268. So thank you very much, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2680 and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.